Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 110. It's Monday, April 19th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, I wanted to begin this show with a segment I'm calling Much Ado About Something Very Little. Now, I'm not saying it's much ado about nothing, but it's much ado about something very little. And you are correct if you guess this is about the rare complication that seems to be messing up the distribution of the J&J COVID-19 vaccine. To sum up, I'd say I feel like I'm in a game show where the contestants are somehow puzzled by some hyped choice. Door number one, you have a 1 in 100 chance of having a significant event happen to your health. Door number two, you have a 1 in 10,000 chance of having such a significant event. Or door number three, you have 1 in 1,000,000 chance of having such a significant event. And people sit there chewing their nails trying to decide. Well, I don't want to overplay it. Risk communication is very difficult, and I want to take this sort of as a case study in risk communication. So let's do a few articles right now. First up, from the Hill, poll, confidence in Johnson & Johnson vaccine drops after CDC pauses use. Americans' confidence in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has dropped following the U.S. government's decision to pause distribution due to reports of very rare blood clots, according to an Economist YouGov poll released last Thursday. The study, which began before the CDC and FDA recommended the pause last Tuesday, found that about 52% of U.S. adults believe the Johnson & Johnson shot was very safe or somewhat safe prior to the pause. After the news last Tuesday, just 37% indicated they believe the inoculation was safe, with 39% feeling it is unsafe. The poll also found that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine has also experienced reduced public confidence amid concerns on blood clots. Approximately 38% of Americans said they believed in the safety of the AstraZeneca shot, which has not yet been approved for emergency use in the U.S. Meanwhile, the shots from Pfizer and Moderna, which along with Johnson & Johnson have received FDA emergency approval, are viewed much more positively among Americans. According to last Thursday's poll, roughly 58% believe the two-dose mRNA vaccines are safe, a percentage which the pollsters noted is relatively unchanged from its last vaccine poll in February. The decision last Tuesday to halt the distribution of the J&J vaccine, which has already been administered to about 7 million people, came after six women who received the shot developed rare blood clots. One woman died and another is in critical condition. An independent advisory group to the CDC said last Wednesday that it was postponing making a recommendation on the shot until it reviews more evidence about a possible link between the inoculation and the blood clots. The distribution phase has fueled concerns about increasing vaccine hesitancy that would complicate further efforts to combat COVID-19. A global pause of the J&J vaccine seems excessive given the popular mythologies that are likely to arise from the statement for all vaccines, Prabhjot Singh, a physician and global health expert at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, told The Hill. However, Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said that he believes the halt could actually diminish vaccine hesitancy by showing how seriously federal agencies are taking vaccine safety. Well, I hope that's true, but here's a different perspective from the Hill. Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause is classic FDA overreach. The Food and Drug Administration's job is to protect the public from snake oil and dangerous drugs. But by telling all healthcare professionals to immediately stop giving the J&J vaccine because of one death in 7 million people, they have transitioned to paternalism. This is not Botox. This is a life-saving medication. If the FDA applied that logic to other medications, we would not have antibiotics, Tylenol, or oral contraceptive pills. The 8 known blood clot complications after the J&J vaccine, including one death, have been observed in people under age 50. All but one were women. The FDA should have responded by pausing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in that specific group. To justify the halt for all Americans, the FDA used its eternal excuse of safety. Under the guise of using abundant caution, as if doing so is not a trade-off, they are suggesting that they are siding with less population risk when they may very well be increasing population risk. But they rarely talk about the hundreds of Americans that have been dying each day from COVID-19 or the race to vaccinate more non-immune people. Not being able to see the forest from the trees while the vaccine is in short supply explains why the FDA has still not approved the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, which the UK has used along with other vaccines to successfully deliver a first dose to most of its country, partially reopening earlier this week, and a plan for full reopening this summer. In my study of the FDA over the years, I would describe them as erratic. In 1995, they approved OxyContin for chronic pain despite any shred of evidence to support it for that indication. Ironically, that approval was overseen by Dr. Janet Woodcock, the current acting director of the FDA, who co-announced the J&J vaccine halt. Doctors make recommendations balancing risks with patients every day. Either we are in a health emergency with a vaccine shortage, or we don't need this life-saving intervention right now. It can't be both. The FDA and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are using peacetime thinking, even more strict than they use to regulate lifestyle medications. But some parts of the country are still at war with this virus. The old guard medical establishment seems uncomfortable recognizing that we have been rationing a life-saving resource. That's also why they rejected the maximized first dose approach the UK used to surpass the US and crush their epidemic. The US has vaccinated 49% of adults. The UK has vaccinated 62% of adults, despite both countries having administered nearly the same amount of vaccines per capita. We need better medical leadership. Okay, we'll make this clear. I just want to put various risks side by side. This from Medical Express, knowing the signs of rare blood clot linked with J&J vaccine. The six women who range from 18 to 48 years of age experienced a rare condition called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, or CVST. Spontaneous CVST is estimated to affect 5 in a million people worldwide each year. So that's the background level you'd expect in a population, 5 in a million per year. And in another article from Medical Express, risk of rare blood clotting much higher in COVID-19 than for vaccines. Researchers at the University of Oxford have reported that the risk of the rare blood clotting known as cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, or CVST, following COVID-19 infection is around 100 times greater than normal, several times higher than its post-vaccination or following influenza. Compared to the current COVID-19 vaccines, the risk after getting COVID is between 8 to 10 times higher, and compared to the baseline level, approximately 100 times higher. So there you go. The real risk of this rare CVST, it actually happens 100 times more than normal with a COVID infection, and 8 to 10 times more than it compared to what would happen post-vaccination. So hardly a choice. Okay, well, let's look at a few other risks that Americans might face. You are literally more likely to be hit by lightning and to get this rare side effect. You have a 1 in 700,000 chance per year to be hit by lightning. So I don't think that would really warrant a recommendation that you should get your shot indoors away from any windows. But, you know, I suppose maybe you should. Dying in a car crash, 1 in 13,000 per year. Being shot to death, that is murder by somebody else, not including suicide, by a firearm, 1 in 20,000 per year. And back to that rare side effect, CVST, 5 in a million. Many, 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 many times less. Now, I think perhaps we should be encouraged that the FDA takes safety very seriously, but the fatal flaw is that it often considers risks in isolation, creating weird risk-benefit recommendations out of sync and out of proportion to other risks that Americans face every day. And I think one of the things psychologically here that drives this is that, of course, some of these risks are voluntary and within our control, and some are not. And the idea that we don't have any control over COVID, which of course we do based on behavior and societal collective responses we do, but there's other things that we don't have any control over. And I think this is the dividing point, that people think if I choose to take a vaccine, that'll produce wondrously more amounts of health and safety in my life, that I don't want to have any risk associated with something I do voluntarily, but if something that I don't have much control over, you know, is 100 or 1,000 or a million times more dangerous, well, I feel a little bit better about that. It's some kind of fate, I guess, that people have. But when you crunch the numbers, that's what we look at in public health. Psychology is nice, but the fact is sick and dead is dead, and we should probably try to avoid those conditions if we can reasonably can. So let's choose door number one with the much less choice chance of getting sick or dead rather than the greater chance. Get vaccinated if you can. Okay, well, like I said earlier, making decisions about health risk and communicating those health risks is, in fact, very difficult. And I want to do a couple articles here that hopefully will give us a more balanced and more nuanced view of risk. First up here from Medical Express, too much unhealthy media coverage of medical tests. This is from the National Health and Medical Research Council. A large global study published in the leading U.S. medical journal JAMA Internal Medicine finds the media is often failing to cover the potential harms of new medical tests, which are designed to detect the early signs of disease in healthy people. The study also found media stories often fail to report on conflicts of interest of researchers promoting the new tests. Researchers from the University of Sydney and Bond University analyzed over 1,100 recent news stories about five new early detection tests, including liquid blood biopsies to detect cancers, the Apple Watch to detect atrial fibrillation, blood tests for dementia, artificial intelligence tests for dementia, and 3D mammography for breast cancer. Failure to cover important potential harms. While almost all of the 1,173 analyzed stories reported on the potential benefits of these tests, over 60% of stories failed to make mention of any potential harms. For all five of the tests covered in our JAMA Internal Medicine study, there is concern that some of the healthy people tested will be wrongly classified as sick, said Dr. Ray Moynihan, senior author on the study. Yet this potential harm of overdiagnosis was only mentioned in 5% of stories. Lead author Dr. Mary O'Keefe said, while these tests sound appealing and can bring benefits, whenever we test sick people, there's a danger that some people will be wrongly classified as sick. This can cause overdiagnosis and overtreatment. Overdiagnosis occurs when people receive a diagnosis of a disease or condition that will never develop to cause any symptoms or early death. It is an unnecessary diagnosis that does more harm than good. Evidence published last year in the Medical Journal of Australia shows that for common cancers, about 1 in 5 cancers may be overdiagnosed. Failure to cover important conflicts of interest. Another key finding from the study is the widespread failure of media stories to cover important conflicts of interest, such as commentators receiving payments from the companies marketing the new tests. For example, 19 of 22 authors of a key trial examining the ability of the Apple Watch to detect atrial fibrillation disclosed taking grants or personal fees from Apple, yet this information was rarely reported in news stories. While over half of the 1,173 stories in the study included the views of commentators with important financial conflicts of interest, these conflicts were only covered in 12% of stories. Okay, so one of the basic points is you don't cover just the benefits and you don't cover just the risks. You look at the risk versus the benefits, and you compare it to other possible options, if there are other possible options available, and you can get a sense of what you're really dealing in the landscape of risk and benefit. And of course, as this article points out, there are kind of meta issues, larger issues, overriding issues of such things as like conflicts of interest and things that that can affect the research credibility. And I try to cover those things. That's one thing you get by me synthesizing this information on Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, being an educated consumer is a good thing. And that leads us into the next article here from Medical Express. A visit to Dr. Google makes patients better at diagnosis. Medical professionals often advise patients not to search the internet for their symptoms before coming into the clinic. Yet many people turn to Dr. Google when feeling sick. Concerns about, quote, cyberchondria, or increased anxiety induced by the internet, have made the value of using internet searches controversial. In a new study that used case vignettes, researchers from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School Department of Healthcare Policy explored the impact internet searches have on patients' ability to reach a correct diagnosis. They found that study outcomes suggest the internet may not be so harmful after all. Participants across the board demonstrated modest improvements in reaching an accurate diagnosis after looking up symptoms on the internet. Participants additionally showed no difference in reported anxiety nor in triage abilities. Results were published in the JAMA Network Open. Well, folks, if critical thinking were easy, everybody'd be doing it. Okay, well, in big COVID-19 vaccination news this week, everybody age 16 or older across the U.S. is eligible. So, if you haven't already been vaccinated and you're age 16 and plus, don't have some contraindication, go for it. Get vaccinated. Take advantage of it. I would like to take this opportunity to reemphasize a point that I often bring up is related to the fact that equality does not equal equity. The fact that everybody now is eligible for it does not mean that we're going to have the most equitable distribution. There are obviously people of different risk, and the prioritization of people risk, putting more resources towards reaching those, will produce better results. And perhaps as a good example of this, here's a good question. Are prisoners that are incarcerated being vaccinated? As we know, people don't value prisoners in our culture very much. And we've seen that throughout the pandemic with testing and treatment. And vaccination is really no different. So when we're having a glut of vaccinations, we can expect that that'll happen. But guess who's last in line? And so while there may be equality today, we're a long way from equity. Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. Again, in this latest wave, to really understand our local situation, we need to recognize that Michigan is the epicenter in the United States today for COVID-19. And not surprisingly, today, the Lucas County Health Department, Toledo Lucas County Health Department, sent out a press release saying that they have detected for the first time the so-called South African variant. And as you remember, this South African variant is one of the really nasty ones that seems to be both more infectious and can cause more serious disease, and perhaps most importantly, really seems to cause reinfection in people who have already naturally been exposed to the virus and experienced the COVID-19 infection. So this opens up a whole much more of the population that's vulnerable. So the race between variants and vaccinations continues. Okay, well, in Lucas County, the average daily number of cases bumped up a little bit to 138 per day. The number of counties in Ohio, 67 of 88 Ohio counties are still considered high incidence. Good news, this is two counties less than last week. Hopefully a reversal of fortune here. The testing positivity rate, that is a proportion, the percentage of people in Lucas County that get a test that end up being positive, jumped up again to 12.2%, quite high. That's bad news. The good news is that it dropped slightly from 4.6 to 4.4% in Ohio. So we'll have to wait and see. We seem to be at a tipping point here. The race is tight. Okay, in nursing homes, we had 30 active cases in Lucas County, 16 residents and 22 staff. This is down slightly after we had a big jump last week after going down to pretty low levels for the previous month. But the increased cases that we've seen over the last month is resulting in new hospitalizations. New hospitalizations are trending up in Lucas County and went up by about 30% in the last week. And hospitalizations in Ohio as a whole are trending up still again this week. Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days, we've had 13 deaths, and that rate is now similar to the state and national death rates. Okay, for the University of Toledo, the case reports of COVID-19 and their surveillance is nothing that noteworthy, but I would like to do a story from CNBC about colleges. More colleges make COVID vaccines mandatory for students. The number of colleges and universities that now say COVID-19 vaccinations will be mandatory for students before they return to campus in the fall is rising daily. At the same time, vaccine hesitancy among parents remains high. The number of colleges and universities that will require students be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 is suddenly escalating. Across the country, campuses struggled to remain open over the last year as fraternities, sororities, and off-campus parties drove sudden spikes in coronavirus cases among undergraduates. Meanwhile, students overwhelmingly declared remote school a mediocre substitute for being in the classroom and on campus. As eligible for COVID vaccines expands to people 16 years and older, schools must consider how a vaccine mandate can help higher education get back on track. For those enrolled in school, there are many vaccination requirements already in place to prevent the spread of diseases such as polio, diphtheria, tetanus, and whooping cough. All 50 states have at least some vaccine mandates for children attending public schools, and even those attending private schools and daycare centers. In every case, there are medical exemptions, and in some cases, there are religious or philosophical exemptions as well. And yet, vaccine hesitancy remains a powerful force among parents. In particular, only 58% of parents or caregivers said they would vaccinate their children against COVID, despite 70% of parents saying they would vaccinate themselves, according to a March poll by Parents Together, a national advocacy group. Colleges do need to get ahead of this and think about how this is going to play out, said Bethany Robertson, co-director of Parents Together. We need to start the conversation with parents now to build trust and understanding about how getting kids vaccinated against COVID-19 protects their health, their family's health, and the health of our communities. And back to Lucas County. With Lucas County schools, we have seen a bump back up after a nice little low in the last couple weeks of identified infections. Big jump up in both staff and students. This is not like super high historically, but it does show and reflect that in Lucas County, the children infection rate is persistently high and a greater proportion of total cases, partly, of course, due to the fact that older populations are being vaccinated and protected. But I want to just reiterate this article that talks about the reality of reinfection among younger populations. This from Science Daily. Study shows past COVID-19 infection doesn't fully protect young people against reinfection. Although antibodies induced by SARS-CoV-2 infection are largely protective, they do not completely protect against reinfection in young people, as evidenced through a longitudinal prospective study of more than 3,000 young, healthy members of the U.S. Marine Corps conducted by the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and the Naval Medical Research Center, published in the Lancet Respiratory Medicine Journal. Our findings indicate that reinfection by SARS-CoV-2 in healthy young adults is common, said Stuart Selfen, the senior author of the paper. Despite a prior COVID-19 infection, young people can catch the virus again and may still transmit it to others. This is an important point to know and remember as vaccine rollouts continue. Young people should get the vaccine whenever possible, since vaccination is necessary to boost immune responses, prevent reinfection, and reduce transmission. Of the 2,346 Marines followed long enough for this analysis of reinfection rate, 189 were seropositive, and 2,247 were seronegative at the start of the study. Among the seropositive participants, 10% tested positive for a second infection during the study. Of the recruits who were seronegative, 48% became infected during the study. So those that had been infected before, 10% of them still got infected again. And of those who weren't had no previous infection, 48% became infected during the study. So again, this kind of looks like this natural infection after the natural immunity after an infection seems to be about an 80% protection among younger people. So it definitely offers some protection, but is nowhere near complete. So get vaccinated, young people, even if you've already had the COVID. Okay, well, as COVID-19 vaccines are open up to everybody age 16 plus, we've seen that those that have received at least one dose were almost at 40% of the total U.S. population, and a little bit lower for Ohio and Lucas County, a couple percent lower for that. But we have reached a real mile mark in America here. Those that have received at least one dose, over 50% of the adult population, that is those 18 and above, have started or completed their vaccinations. So we're getting there, people. We're getting there. Okay, well, I've been covering racial ethnic disparities in Lucas County in Ohio, and we saw a tiny little bump, whereas Lucas County blacks were only 48% as likely to be vaccinated as whites the last couple of weeks, and it's only bumped up a few percent over the last 6 weeks. It's up to almost 50% in Lucas County. So blacks are still half as likely to have been vaccinated as whites in Lucas County, but the gap is narrowing ever so slowly. In Ohio, we had a few percent bump, and in Ohio, blacks are 58% as likely to have been vaccinated as whites. And it's important to note, because there's a lot of talk about black folks being more reticent to get a vaccination, but of those that remain unvaccinated, blacks are at least as likely to want a vaccine at this point as whites are. Partly that's due to having the fact that more whites have already been vaccinated. But for the hesitancy that's coming up now, it's a lot of it is white men, conservative white men in particular, that are the most vaccine hesitant. Okay, well, if you want to get a vaccine in Ohio, go to gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. You are listening to Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Okay, well, of course, COVID-19 is not the only thing happening in public health in America. This from Medical Express. U.S. overdose deaths have soared during COVID-19 pandemic. There were more than 87,000 drug overdose deaths in the United States from October 2019 to September 2020, the highest of any one-year period since the nation's opioid crisis began in the 1990s, preliminary government data show. The death toll was 29% higher than in the previous 12-month period, and the increase was largely driven by illicitly manufactured fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, with stimulant drugs such as methamphetamine also playing a role, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported. Whites in rural and suburban areas accounted for many of the deaths in the early years of the U.S. opioid epidemic, but the latest data show blacks being affected disproportionately now. The highest increase in mortality from opioids, predominantly driven by fentanyl, is now among black Americans, Dr. Nora Volkoff, director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, said at an addiction conference last week. And when you look at mortality from methamphetamine, it's chilling to realize that the risk of dying from methamphetamine overdose is 12-fold higher among American Indians and Alaskan Natives than other groups. Dr. Volkoff added that more deaths than ever involve drug combinations, typically of fentanyl or heroin with stimulants. Overdose deaths fell slightly in 2018 for the first time in decades, but started to climb again the months before the COVID-19 pandemic and had the highest spike in April and May 2020. In the early months of the pandemic, many addiction treatment centers shut down, at least temporarily, and services are reduced at many drop-in centers that offer support, clean syringes, and the overdose reversal medication naloxone. In many cases, these services have not been fully restored. Also, the drug overdose crisis has received less attention and resources as the country struggles with the COVID-19 pandemic. Okay, I think the hidden interesting thing in this article is it's titled U.S. Overdose Deaths Have Soared During COVID-19 Pandemic, which isn't untrue, but the key thing to look at here is this last paragraph when it said, but started to climb again the months before the COVID-19 pandemic. So this was a trend that had already begun, and I've reported on this before, is the drop that we had in 2018 was really related to something that happened in the regulatory environment in China, where they clamped down on fentanyl production and export, if you want to call it that. It's not legal, but illegal export. So that actually dropped the supply of fentanyl availability in the U.S., which of course dropped overdoses. But now that other things are starting to intervene to ramp up supply again, we're seeing that the epidemic again is heating up and exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Okay, well, a couple of weeks ago, I reported some really good news that it looks like that suicides actually decreased in the U.S. in 2020, which is a little bit astounding. But part of it just gets at the fact that we don't understand suicide that well, particularly from a clinical point of view. And this from Mad in America. Study: suicide risk prediction is poor. Attempts to predict suicide risk using clinical judgment or machine learning algorithms are not useful in clinical practice. A new study aimed to compare suicide risk prediction, including clinical judgment and machine learning algorithms, to see what method was best. Unfortunately, none of the methods were clinically useful, and new algorithms were not statistically any better than clinical judgment. The authors wrote, until such time as the use of any suicide prediction model has been shown to reliably reduce suicide, our clinical advice is to focus on understanding and caring for the person in front of us, including by treating any modifiable risk factors, irrespective of estimations of any overall suicide risk category. The authors conducted a meta-analysis of 86 studies, including 102 predictive models, to determine if any type of model was better than any other for predicting suicide. The authors found that including more risk factors did not improve predictability for clinical judgment, more objective measures, or computerized algorithms. And they concluded with this wonderful statement, it might be that suicide is fundamentally unpredictable. Wow, folks, well, that's your way existential statement for the day. And this is a really good case of the divide between statistics and an individual occurrence. Statistics are really good at understanding populations, which of course is what public health is about. Clinicians are concerned about individuals. And we've known for a long time that the ability of clinicians to predict who's going to commit suicide is really bad. But we do, of course, have a lot of social determinants that predict suicide as a population. So for larger interventions, you know, we're not unable to deal with it. But from clinicians, the reality is it's just nearly impossible to predict who's going to commit suicide. So this is really a divide between clinical and population applications. And as an example of social determinants in suicide, this from Medical Express. Suicide among female nurses is double that of the general female population. Female nurses are roughly twice as likely to commit suicide than the general female population and 70% more likely than female physicians, according to a University of Michigan study examining suicide among physicians and nurses. There are roughly 3 million nurses working in the United States, making the country's largest healthcare workforce, 85% of whom are women. I will just note the cruel irony that in the context of healing professions, healers are actually more likely to take their own life. This goes back to what I've commented and reported on a lot about moral injury. People that are in healing professions that are in systems and settings that make it very difficult to actually heal. And this can be devastating at the individual level as well for the caregivers. And women in particular have higher risks of psychosocial stress. This from Science Daily. Stress from work and social interactions put women at higher coronary heart disease risk. Psychosocial stress, typically resulting from difficulty coping with challenging environments, may work synergistically to put women at significantly higher risk of developing coronary heart disease, according to a study by researchers at Drexel University School of Public Health, recently published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. The study specifically suggests that the effects of job strain and social strain, the negative aspect of social relationships on women, is a powerful 1-2 punch. Together, they are associated with a 20% higher risk of developing coronary heart disease. Job strain occurs when a woman has inadequate power in the workplace to respond to the job's demands and expectations. The study also found that high-stress life events, such as a spouse's death, divorce separation, or physical or verbal abuse, as well as social strain, were each independently linked with a 12% and 9% higher risk of coronary heart disease, respectively. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted ongoing stresses for women in balancing paid work and social stressors. We know that from other studies that work strain may play a role in developing heart disease. But now we can better pinpoint the combined impact of stress at work and at home on these poor health outcomes, said senior author Dr. Yvonne Michael. Okay, well now I'd like to do a series of stories on racial, ethnic, and gender disparities. This from Medical Express. Physicians are more likely to doubt black patients than white patients. When the 21st Century Cures Act was implemented, healthcare providers were required to give their patients free access to all the health information in their electronic medical records. This just took effect. Black patients are much more likely than white patients to discover language in those records that indicates they are not believed by their physicians, according to a new study by Johns Hopkins University published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. We set out to see if we could identify linguistic mechanisms through which physicians communicate disbelief of patients in medical records, and, if so, to explore racial and gender differences in the use of such language, said Mary Catherine Beach, a faculty member at the University School of Medicine and Public Health and a core faculty member at the Berman Institute of Bioethics. Our analysis of medical record language suggests black patients are less likely to be believed by physicians. The bias reflected in those medical records may in turn affect care from future clinicians. And next up from Science Daily as well, a new study suggests that when men and women express the same amount of pain, women's pain is considered less intense based on gender stereotypes. In a recent study published in the Journal of Pain, co-authored by Elizabeth Lowson, assistant professor of psychology and director of the Social and Cultural Neuroscience Lab at the University of Miami, researchers found that a patient's pain responses may be perceived differently by others based on their gender. According to gender biases in estimation of others' pain, when male and female patients express the same amount of pain, observers viewed female patients' pain as less intense and more likely to benefit from psychotherapy versus medication as compared to men's pain, exposing a significant patient gender bias that could lead to disparities in treatments. If the stereotype is to think women are more expressive than men, perhaps overly expressive, then the tendency will be to discount women's pain behaviors, Lowson said. The flip side of this stereotype is that men are perceived to be stoic. So when a man makes an intense pain facial expression, you think, oh my, he must be dying. The result of this gender stereotype about pain expression is that each unit of increased pain expression from a man is thought to represent a higher increase in his pain experience than that same increase in pain expression by a woman. Additionally, the study concluded that the gender of the perceivers did not influence pain estimation. Both men and women interpreted women's pain to be less intense. The idea to study disparities in the perception of pain based on a patient's gender was derived from previous research, Lowson said, that found women are often prescribed less treatment than men and wait longer to receive that treatment as well. I think one critical piece of information that could be conveyed in medical curricula is that people, even those with medical training and other studies, have been found to have consistent demographic biases in how they assess the pain of male and female patients, and that these biases impact treatment decisions. Critically, our results demonstrate that these gender biases are not necessarily accurate. Women are not necessarily more expressive than men, and thus their pain expression should not be discounted. Amen to that. And next up, a couple stories affecting pregnant women. This from Fierce Healthcare. Study: 1 in 3 women with prenatal Medicaid lack coverage before or after pregnancy. While many pregnant women gain coverage through Medicaid, ensuring they have insurance after giving birth remains a significant challenge, according to a new study. Researchers at the Urban Institute found that 26.8% of new mothers covered for prenatal care through Medicaid were uninsured prior to becoming pregnant. In addition, 22% became uninsured again within 2 to 6 months of their child's birth, the study found. Women experiencing uninsurance, both preconception and postpartum, indicates a lack of accessible public and private coverage options outside of pregnancy, the researchers wrote. These women may temporarily benefit from a postpartum extension, but would likely need additional support to maintain coverage after it expires and before any subsequent pregnancy. Just another call for universal health insurance, my friends. And from the Hill, U.S. maternal death rate climbed in 2019 with enduring racial disparities, from federal data. The U.S. recorded a climb in its maternal death rate from 2018 to 2019, and racial disparities in the data remained, according to a CDC report. When broken down by race, non-Hispanic black women had 44 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2019, amounting to 2.5 times more than non-Hispanic white women and 3.5 times more than Hispanic women. Only non-Hispanic white women experienced a statistically significant increase in their maternal death rates, reaching 18 per 100,000 live births. Non-Hispanic black and Hispanic women's rates did not face a statistically significant increase from the previous year. As the age of the mother increased, the maternal mortality rate rose, with those aged 40 and more having 6 times the rate compared with women under 25. The CDC has labeled 2/3 of maternal deaths as, quote, preventable, as the U.S. struggles with the highest maternal mortality rate among 10 other highly developed countries, according to the Commonwealth Fund's analysis of data from 2018. That research determined the U.S.'s rate was more than double France's, the runner-up in the study. Wow, not even close. We're the worst. Come on, America. We can do better. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears now and do 4 stories related to nutrition. This is from Medical Express. Study finds Americans eat food of mostly poor nutritional quality, except at school. Whether eating out or buying food from the grocery store, Americans of all ages are, for the most part, eating poorly everywhere, except at school. The information comes from a new dietary trend study, which also reveals persistent or worsening disparities in meal quality from restaurants, grocery stores, and other sources, but not school. These worsening trends are by race, ethnicity, and income. By 2018, the most recent year for which national data is available, meals with the lowest nutritional quality came from restaurants, where 65% of adult meals and 80% of children's meals were of poor quality. Entertainment venues and food trucks were the next worst, with 44% of adult meals and 52% of children's meals being of poor nutritional quality. At work sites, 51% of adult meals eaten were of poor dietary quality. Grocery stores were better sources of food, with 33% of adult meals eaten and 45% of children's meals being of poor quality. Schools were best, where only 24% of meals consumed by children were of poor nutritional quality. Schools are now the single healthiest place Americans are eating. This finding is particularly timely given widespread school closures over the last year from COVID-19 and current efforts to safely and fully reopen schools. Our results suggest substantial nutritional harms for millions of kids who have not been consistently receiving meals at school and must rely on other sources. These harms are also disproportionately affect low-income Black and Latinx children, said Dariush Mozafarian, dean of the Friedman School and senior author of the study. Analyzing the diets of about 40,000 adults and 21,000 children between 2003 and 2018, the research team found significant improvements in all nutritional quality of school food consumed over this period, almost all happening after the passage of the Federal Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act in 2010. which mandated much stronger school and early child care nutrition standards. The findings represent food as actually consumed from different U.S. sources, not what is theoretically available to be purchased. In U.S. children from 2003 to 2018, the proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from restaurants declined least, from 85% to 80%. The proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from grocery stores declined modestly, from 53% to 45%. The proportion of poor quality nutritional quality food consumed from schools was cut by more than half, from 57% to 24%. Significant disparities were seen in improvements in food consumed from grocery stores, with greater improvements among whites than blacks or Hispanics, and among children in households with greater family income or heads of households with higher educational attainment than with lower income or education. In contrast, improvements in food consumed from schools were equitable by race, ethnicity, education, and household income. Our results underscore the fact that the nutritional quality of most meals, snacks, and drinks consumed in the U.S. remains poor, and with important differences by where the food is obtained. Improvement in schools was especially striking, large, and equitable across population subgroups. This is clearly linked to the 2010 Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, a powerful lesson on how a single federal policy could improve both nutrition and equity for millions of Americans. These findings are especially timely with the new focus of the presidential administration, USDA, and Congress on nutrition security. The nutritional improvements in foods obtained at schools came from kids eating more of what's good for them, such as whole grains, total fruits, greens and beans, and less of what's harmful, such as sugary drinks, refined grains, and foods with added sugars, said first author Jiangxiao Lu, a postdoctoral school at the Friedman School. These were the specific targets of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. Despite these improvements, school meals only provided 9% of calories for the average child over the course of an entire year, highlighting the importance of improving the nutritional quality of food choices from other sources. Grocery stores accounted for 65% of calories of children and 67% for adults, followed by restaurants at 19% of calories for children and 22% of calories for adults. Other sources, such as gifts from others, food trucks, and entertainment venues, represented 8% of calories for children and 9% for adults. Additional results for U.S. adults from 2003 to 2018 include: the proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from restaurants remained relatively stable at 65%. The proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from workplaces declined modestly, from 56% to 51%. The proportion of poor nutritional quality food consumed from grocery stores declined modestly, from 40% to 33%. COVID-19 has changed the equation for where Americans are getting their food. Grocery stores were the main source before the pandemic, a trend that has only accelerated, including online. Restaurants that have survived the pandemic are now reopening. This is a perfect time to take stock of our food sources and choices as a nation and find policy solutions to put better nutrition on the table for all Americans. And next up, in a somewhat related story from Science Daily, time to shift from food security to nutrition security to increase health and well-being. In the 1960s, a national focus on hunger was essential to address major problems of undernutrition after World War II. In the 1990s, the nation shifted away from hunger toward food insecurity to better capture and address the challenges of food access and affordability. Now, a new Viewpoint article argues that today's health and equity challenges call for the U.S. to shift from food insecurity to nutrition insecurity in order to catalyze appropriate focus and policies on access not just to food, but to healthy, nourishing food. The Viewpoint by Darius Mozafarian of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University was published online in JAMA. The concept of food security focuses on access to and affordability of food that is safe, nutritious, and consistent with personal preferences. In reality, however, the nutritious part has often been overlooked or lost in national policies and solutions, with resulting emphasis on quantity rather than quality of food, says the authors. Food is essential both for life and human dignity. Every day I see hunger, but the hunger I see is not only for calories, but for nourishing meals. With a new focus on nutrition security, we embrace a solution that nourishes people instead of filling them with food but leaving them hungry, said Chef Jose Andre, founder of World Central Kitchen. The authors define nutrition security as having consistent access to and availability and affordability of foods and beverages that promote well-being while preventing it and, if needed, treating disease. Nutrition security provides a more inclusive view that recognizes that foods must nourish all people. Nutrition security incorporates all the aims of food security, but with additional emphasis on the need for wholesome, healthful foods and drinks for all. COVID-19 has made clear that Americans who are more likely to be hungry are also at highest risk of diet-related diseases, including obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and many cancers, a harsh legacy of inequities and structural racism in our nation. A new focus on nutrition security for all Americans will help crystallize and catalyze real solutions that provide not only food, but also well-being for everyone, the first author, Darius Mazafarian, said. It's the right time for this evolution. By prioritizing nutrition security, we bring together historically siloed areas, hunger and nutrition, which must be tackled together to effectively address our modern challenge of diet-related diseases and disparities in clinical care, government food and food assistance policies, public health investments, and national research. The current approach is not sufficient, the authors write, and traditionally marginalized minority groups, as well as people living in rural and lower-income counties, are most likely to experience disparities in nutrition quality, food insecurity, and corresponding diet-related diseases. So, folks, food is more than just about quantity. We got to think about nutritional quality as well. Long way to go. Let's get to it. Okay, well, this next article from Medical Express is a tantalizing example of how nutrition can play a role in many conditions. Gut microbiome plays a role in autism. A new study has demonstrated that autism spectrum disorder is related to changes in the gut microbiome. The findings were published this week in M Systems, an open access journal of the American Society for Microbiology. Longitudinally, we were able to see that within an individual, changes in the microbiome were associated with changes in behavior, said principal study investigator Catherine Luzapone, a microbiologist in the Department of Medicine, University of Colorado. If we're going to understand the link between the gut microbiome and autism, we need more collaborative efforts across different regions and centers to get really thorough, generalizable information about this relationship. We need more research, but our work shows that the gut microbiome is playing a role in the provocation of symptoms in kids with autism spectrum disorder. This further supports the fact that the gut microbiome could be a valuable therapeutic target for children with autism spectrum disorders. I know that some labs have been exploring things like fecal microbiome transplant in these children and have had some promising results. Further work to tease out the mechanisms at play could lead to new therapies for children with autism. Of course, this microbiome research is probably the most exciting and interesting area of nutrition research and offers a lot of promise, so we'll keep an eye on that. Okay, well, this next story may be a little bit of a disappointment for some of you supplement freaks. The U.S. Preventive Task Force finds evidence insufficient for vitamin D screening. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force concludes that the current evidence is insufficient to ascertain the balance of benefits and harms of screening asymptomatic adults for vitamin D deficiency. These findings form the basis of a final recommendation statement published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Based on these findings, the task force concludes the evidence is lacking on the benefits of vitamin D deficiency screening among community-dwelling, non-pregnant adults with no signs or symptoms of vitamin D deficiency. So basically, unless you are pregnant, they couldn't find any good reason or benefit for screening asymptomatic people. In other words, people do not have signs of vitamin D deficiency. In my view, as I've stated before, I think vitamin D is one of the most overrated, hyped things in nutrition these days. Again, it might not be nothing, but it's much ado about very little. Eat real food, wholesome and nutritious. And it's okay to get a little bit of sunshine as well for your vitamin D. Okay, folks, we'll perk up. Here's an interesting story that offers a free resource as well from Science Daily. How to gain a sense of well-being, free and online. That's what I love. In 2018, when Professor Lori Santos introduced her course, Psychology and the Good Life, a class on the science of happiness, it became the most popular in the history of Yale, attracting more than 1,200 undergraduate enrollees that first semester. An online course based on those teachings became a global phenomenon. By latest count, 3.4 million people have enrolled to take the free Coursera.org course called The Science of Well-Being. I'll repeat that at the end of the story. But the popularity of the course posed an interesting question. Does taking the course and participating in homework assignments, which include nurturing social connections, compiling a gratitude list, and meditation, really help improve a sense of well-being? The answer is yes, according to two new studies that measured the psychological impact on individuals who took Santos or a similar course. The findings suggest that free online courses that teach principles of positive psychology can enrich the lives of millions of people. The classes are not a substitute for professional treatment for those who suffer from diagnosed mental illness. These courses are not a panacea or replacement for psychotherapy or medication. However, the findings show that massive open online courses can provide at least modest value to millions of people at no cost. We wanted to know if we could scale these benefits, and we can. Even bringing a small mental health benefit to millions of people can have a huge value. So if you want to check that out, you can go to Coursera.org, that's Coursera.org, and look for the course called The Science of Well-Being, Coursera.org. Okay, and while the internet can be a very useful technology for health promotion, this one's a little bit different. Biotech, which I'm usually not putting at the center of health and wellness, can offer a lot of benefits. This from Discover Magazine. Beyond COVID, the future of mRNA is bright. The term mRNA only entered the average household in the past few months as Moderna and Pfizer released their COVID-19 vaccines. But a handful of scientists have spent decades studying this novel approach to immunization. By the start of the pandemic, the technology was already so advanced that when Chinese researchers published the genetic sequence for the coronavirus in mid-January, Moderna was able to concoct a vaccine within 48 hours. Clinical trials began a matter of weeks after that. In 9 months, the world was well on its way to viral security. It was a stunning debut for mRNA, shorthand for messenger ribonucleic acid, DNA's sidekick, which is long ranked as a promising but unproven treatment. After this encouraging success, its proponents predict an equally impressive future. They have always believed in mRNA's ability to protect against not only the likes of coronavirus, but also a host of deadly diseases that resist traditional vaccines, from malaria to HIV to cancer. In 2018, long before the past year's confidence-boosting display, a group of researchers announced a new era in vaccinology. It remains to be seen whether mRNA will live up to the hype. With concrete results attesting to its potential, though, interest is growing among investors and researchers alike. It helps that regulating agencies and the public are familiar with it now, too, says Yale immunologist Rick Bukila. That has really changed the landscape. Andrew Giall, co-founder of one company testing RNA vaccines and chief scientific officer of another, notes that mRNA has only just entered its infancy after a long gestation. Such is the nature of scientific progress. We've had the technology bubbling for 20 years, and the major breakthrough in this clinical proof of two vaccines, he says. Now we're set for 10 years of excitement. But besides liberating the world from the worst pandemic in generations, mRNA could help to vanquish many an intractable disease. If all the dreams of its advocates are realized, the COVID vaccines may, in hindsight, be only a proof of concept. In February, for example, Bukila and his colleagues patented a vaccine against malaria, which has likely killed more humans than any other single cause and has mostly withstood immunization. Justin Richner, an immunologist with the University of Illinois Chicago, is developing an mRNA vaccine for dengue, another highly resistant virus. Because mRNA is simply a genetic sequence, scientists can easily tweak it as necessary to find the most effective combination. One of the advantages of the mRNA platform is how it can be so easily modified and manipulated to test novel hypotheses, Richner says. Giall says the obvious candidate for mRNA vaccines includes what he calls the Big Six, all of which remain crafty foes: malaria, cancer, tuberculosis, HIV, cytomegalovirus, and respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. Currently, it's difficult to tell whether an mRNA vaccine will work on any particular pathogen. Many have shown promise in animal trials only to falter in our species. As Geol put it, mice are not humans. Some appear to be better bets than others, cytomegalovirus and RSV in particular. But for now, it's too early to say where mRNA will next bear fruit. Despite all we know about immunology, a lot of it is really empiric, Bukila says. You just have to try things and see if they work. Since 2018, Pfizer and BioNTech have been working on an mRNA vaccine for seasonal flu. Under the status quo, experts must predict which variation of the virus will pose the greatest threat each year and produce vaccines to match it. But because mRNA is so easy to edit, it can be modified more efficiently to keep pace with the ever-mutating strains. I do think the influenza vaccine field will be transformed in the not-too-distant future, Richner says. After mRNA's brilliant battle against COVID, it's tempting to think of it as a panacea. But Bukila adds, is there something intrinsically revolutionary about mRNA? We don't know yet. Even if some mRNA endeavors fizzle out, at least a few are bound to make the world proud. We are going to see failures, but we're going to see successes for sure. Okay, and last but not least, we have five bonus articles that you can read online. Number one, when a cardiologist flagged the lack of diversity at premier medical journals, the silence was telling. Two, underserved communities bear the brunt of a paused Johnson & Johnson rollout. Three, incarcerated and infected, how the virus tore through the U.S. prison system. Four, vaccines won't protect millions of patients with weakened immune systems, but researchers are testing one therapy that may help, monoclonal antibodies. And five, Biden faces pressures from Pelosi and Sanders over whether to double down on Obamacare or expand Medicare. You can read the articles that I covered in this entire show, and plus these, at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.